Thanks so much for inviting me. Pleasure to be here. I've actually never told my own story in public before, so I know a number of you very well, and you might hear some surprising things. My hope is that some of what I share this morning might bring up the stories and circumstances in your own life, things and places and people that have inspired you. For starters, I want you to know that you're not the first Unitarians I've ever met. My mother's brother, Tom, from German-Jewish background, married my Aunt Susan, whose mother was a Christian Scientist and whose father was a Presbyterian, and yes, a mixed marriage, and they had a coming together, and it's like, how are we gonna raise our children? My four cousins, and they raised their children Unitarians, and my Uncle Tom taught religious school there, and to sweeten the pot, in order to get my cousins to go to religious school, they would stop at Dunkin' Donuts on the way. those were different times for Unitarians. When you could make a stop at Dunkin' Donuts and also vote Republican. My aunt and uncle were Republicans, so anybody in this place voting Republican? I grew up in an assimilationist, secular, Jewish family in suburban Chicago. My family had a portrait and wedding photography business started by my great-grandfather in 1902. That man, Edward Fox, came to the U.S. from Russia at the age of 13 alone. That business lasted more than 100 years. My brother and dad sold it in 2005. We weren't wealthy, but as my mom used to say, we were comfortable. At an early age, I also felt that we were privileged, something I didn't feel very good about. And I was kind of ashamed of it. And it's something I've spent much of my life wrestling with and trying to address, and in many ways trying to make use of. My parents had a profound influence on me. Both independent characters in their own right, they felt no need to conform to the vagaries of popular culture. I learned that it was okay to be different. My dad, I have to digress for a moment. My dad's a big storyteller, and one of his best lines is, the only thing that can get in the way of a good story is an eyewitness. I love that line. My dad told me that if I worked hard enough, I could accomplish anything I wanted. It wasn't necessarily true, but it taught me to set my sights high. My dad's mom, my grandmother, worked at the family business until a year before she died at age 88. That longtime family focus on work likely turned me into a workaholic. It also helped me be bold and challenging where I'd come from and the community that I'd settle in here, and what I wanted this community to be like. My mom, although she would not have described herself this way, was the first community organizer I ever met. There was an empty lot next door to where me and my brother and all of the neighbor kids played. There were huge elm trees on this lot, and for quite a few years, the city had plans to turn that lot into a parking lot. My mom and the neighbors fought that proposal year after year for many years, countless phone calling campaigns, countless ventures down to City Hall to speak at public meetings. They won. That lot is still empty. The elms are gone, but the city has now planted maple trees in their place. That was my first introduction to what I later read from Margaret Mead. I'm sure many of you know this quote, "Never doubt that a small group of committisons can change the world. It's the only thing that ever has." It's also my first exposure to the importance of working with others. Lest you be seen as shouting with rage in the wilderness and accomplishing very little. My grandfather Ben, my dad's dad, had a profound impact on me as well. Wasn't an orator or a labor organizer or a scholar, but a blue-collar worker, disabled by Parkinson's disease at age 35. He went on to keep framing photographs in the family business until he was 80. He was my first genuine underdog hero, living decently against very long odds. He lived with us a few days a week. My brother and I helped get him dressed. We put him to bed, and his love for us was unconditional. He babysat for us when my folks went out, and most importantly, he let us watch whatever TV shows we wanted. In April of 1968, I was in fourth grade. My family took a family vacation to Florida and stayed at the Doral Country Club so my dad could play golf. Doral Country Club, now owned by none other than Donald Trump. Donald Trump. All the guests were white, all the help was black. The community we lived in back home was all white, but we had lots of black help coming from other places. The garbage man, Rufus, was black. Mr. Hickman, our school bus driver, was black. Zula was a black maid who came to clean our house once a week when we were very young. When we were staying at Doral on vacation, Martin Luther King was shot and killed. It was announced in the big dining hall that night at dinner. I was in shock. I couldn't understand how that could have happened. I remember leaving the dining room early on my own and walking back to our hotel room. I remember walking past the hotel registration desk and looking at the black clerks behind the counter. But they didn't look at me. Their eyes were down. That juxtaposition of the killing of the public leader of the very people that took care of my family made a big impact. And it quite likely ignited a lifelong interest in working for racial justice. About 4 or 5 months later, I met my fifth grade teacher, Martin Delaney. Totally hated him. My first week of class, the first male teacher I'd ever had. He turned out to be the best teacher I ever had, ever. When we were reading Lord of the Flies in fifth grade, a book most people don't read till high school, Delaney taught the class what scapegoating was about. If you remember, Piggy is the scapegoat in Lord of the Flies. Delaney taught the class what scapegoating was about by sending me, the class goody-goody, out in the hall. Standard punishment for those who were screwing up in class. So whenever anyone in class would screw up, Dougie boy, go out in the hall. I learned pretty quickly what scapegoat meant. About 5 years later, I learned from a classmate that Delaney, who had left public teaching after about 3 years, was gay. He was the first gay person I knew in my life, followed by many others. He was my hero before that moment, and much later as well, when he became the founder of Project Inform in San Francisco and became a globally known and highly respected AIDS activist. There's so many stories about so many of these people. I am cutting it short. I'll just say, my mother, Delaney, my parents would have Delaney stay with us when they went on vacation. My mother was a major homophobe. She loved Delaney. Years later, she knew Delaney was gay, but she just couldn't believe it. You know, I mean, it was just fascinating. A good chunk of years later, there appeared in my life a woman that a number of you know, the woman I'd married, Joanne Thomas. In our 39 years together before she passed 21 months ago, Joanne taught me many things, many of which could be summarized by that bumper sticker that says, "Listen to women for a change." Joanne could cut a man down with feminist analysis and such biting humor that you'd be laughing at yourself as you fell to your knees pleading mercy. Our relationship began at work, where she was my supervisor. One day, Joanne complained of a stiff neck and shoulders. And I did what today would undoubtedly get me fired. Standing behind her, Joanne seated at her desk, I gave her a shoulder massage. Our relationship blossomed, if you will, although she remained my supervisor on most matters for the rest of our marriage. And her intelligent and witty analysis of what was going on in the world made me far more astute and aware every day. Our daughters, Ellie and Syl, have proven to be incredibly aware, wise, loving, and perceptive young women. Like their mom, they similarly keep me humble and accountable to this day. Early in my community organizing career, a colleague of mine, Frank Hornstein, helped me begin my entry back into Judaism, which I basically ejected from my life at my confirmation at age 16, yelling as I left the sanctuary, "Wahoo! I'm out of here!" Frank told me that organizing and social justice work were very Jewish things to do. That kindled a new interest in Judaism, the religion I'd grown up with, but I'd known little of its focus on social justice. A couple years later, Joanne and I were visiting Frank and his wife, Marcy Zimmerman, in New York. Marcy was studying to be a rabbi. So we're walking together in Manhattan down the street. A homeless man approached us on the street. I did my best to avoid him. Marcy, on the other hand, stopped, opened up her purse, gave him a buck. She saw my mouth wide open, aghast, and said to me, "Doug, it's the Jewish thing to do." Little did I know. One of my most important influences was Steve O'Neill, an organizing mentor. Steve was a strong social justice Catholic who, along with his wife, would go on to work in the Catholic worker movement for many years. They were major mentors of Mary Farrell and the Catholic worker here in Winona as well. In about 1985, Steve and I were at a social gathering at Cherie's farmhouse outside Zumbro Falls. We were celebrating an important land stewardship project victory, and I was palling along with Steve, really the only person I knew at this party. I'd just moved to Southeast Minnesota. At one point, do you remember this story? At one point, Steve greeted Father Bernard Kerrigan, the elderly Catholic priest serving parishes in Wabasha, Kellogg, and Tileman, who'd been active in the Land Stewardship Project's local efforts. "Hello, Father." "Hello, Steve, good to see you." I want to mention that they were both living in Southeast Minnesota. They were both originally from the southwest side of Chicago. "How have you been, Father?" "Good, Steve, just got back from Chicago. Been to the old neighborhood lately?" "No, Father, haven't been there for a while." "It's changing, Steve, it's changing. Well, what do you mean, Father? They're moving in, Steve. They're moving in. Well, who's moving in, Father? The blacks, Steve. The blacks. They're moving in. What I witnessed next was my friend Steve, about 33 years old, take on this elderly priest, a redeemed figure in the community. Father, you're wrong. Dead wrong. I don't agree with you, Father. If that's the change you're seeing, that change is for the good. That was my first time seeing a white man I knew stand up to somebody's bigotry and prejudice. The irony of me winding up living and working with rural people for the last 40 years can't be overstated. Growing up in Chicago, there was a huge and disdainful attitude about rural people and really rural places. There was a cheer that Chicago area high school fans would employ to intimidate rural teams at the state basketball tournament. Go back, go back, go back to the woods. Your coach is a farmer and your team is no good. When I started my job at the Land Stewardship Project in the mid-1980s, I most certainly realized the error of this urban superiority. The farmers I met were Renaissance people, mechanics, weathermen, agronomists, soil scientists, gardeners, caretakers of livestock, foresters, all in one mind and body. Very savvy people, deeply connected to the land and their community. I learned from another key mentor, Victor Ray, to employ a method of organizing and facilitation where we built meetings around listening to these very farmers. By listening, I became very grounded in rural working class life. It proved to be the foundation for building trust and relationship with hundreds of people over the years. And those relationships have been central to the work I've done. These people were definitely my equals, if not my superiors. I could name countless rural people I've worked with who've inspired me, taught me, held me accountable, a number of whom are in this room. I'll mention some. A St. Charles farmer and nurse named Pat Finley, who would remind us, Mother Nature always bats last. A crop and livestock farmer named Bob Christie between Utica and St. Charles, who, when offered by a frac sand company to sell them his hills for frac sand mining, said no way, and then at an incredible profit, I will add, and then when he met with Governor Dayton in a meeting of eight people, were you at that meeting, Kelly? Laid out the most eloquent stewardship letter I've heard, equivalent to Wendell Berry. I asked Bob later when I had a high school education, Bob, do you know Wendell Berry? Never heard of them. How about Barb Nelson and Margaret Walsh, who over the last 15 years have likely made 15,000 phone calls, no exaggeration, to fellow Winona County residents urging them to contact their elected officials or vote in favor of candidates that protect the land and water and small farms. And then there's Cherie. Who stood up to powerful interests in the name of stewardship and justice countless times in your life? And what about Debbie Niebuhr? How much good has been generated in this community by one woman These are the kinds of people that inspire me and keep me going. Here's a Joe Moore story. Usually I just wipe tears away. I actually remembered to bring Kleenex today. My sleeves are stained with tears. Here's a Joe Moore story. For those that didn't know Joe, local, rural, Winona County boy who at age 19 in 1964 went to Mississippi to work for Civil Rights and Freedom Summer. Stayed 3 years. That experience led to 50 more years of organizing for people on the land, the last 30 of which were here in Winona County. I helped organize a multiracial theater troupe about 20 years ago here in Winona to look at issues of race, class, and gender. Joe wasn't part of the group, but as you'll hear, he was of important counsel. When the group needed a treasurer, a young, low-income black man in our group, someone we all loved, volunteered for the job, we were thrilled. I mean, how egalitarian is that? Putting a young, poor black guy in charge of the money. Well, to make a long story short, I was writing a grant report once and I looked at our financial records and I noticed that there were some unexplained withdrawals. I asked this young man about this and he admitted to helping himself to some cash. I couldn't believe it. This was a guy we loved, trusted, and respected, the life of our troop. I called Joe, told him the story, and asked his advice. Joe said, "Well, did you give him any training or orientation on the rules, roles, and responsibilities of being treasurer?" I said, "No." Joe said, Doug, you put a low-income individual in charge of the money with free access to the money and give him no training in how he was supposed to handle it. Just what the hell did you expect was going to happen?" In the early 2000s, I was working with migrant workers, and I needed to learn Spanish. I befriended the Gasca brothers who were working on a farm in the area. I was teaching them a bit of English, like how to order a hamburger, a cheeseburger at McDonald's. They would teach me a bit of Spanish, but I wasn't learning much. I decided to go to an immersion language school in Mexico and picked one an hour away from their home village in Guanajuato. Is that where you went listening? That was the place they spent the winters. I visited the Gascas the day before heading home and had a meal with Olegario Gasca, the brother I knew best. It was March and I asked when he was heading back north. "I'm leaving tomorrow," he told me. That was when I was leaving too. And then it hit me. I'd take a 4-hour plane ride from the Guanajuato León airport to Minneapolis, and then I'd drive home. I'd be home in 7 hours. Olegario would take a bus to the border, spend 4 days trying to cross the desert on foot, spend a couple days in a van with others, driving 2 days and 2 nights back to Minnesota. And that's if he didn't get hurt or get picked up by Border Patrol or vigilantes. My trip, 7 hours. His trip, if he was lucky, 7 days. That hammered home for me the importance of working for immigration reform. Why couldn't he just come home with me on that plane? Last story. A couple weeks ago, I was doing a morning breakfast shift at the Bethany House. You all know the Bethany House, Catholic worker house here on Broadway. I sat down at the table in the dining room and looked up on the wall, and there among the framed posters of Dorothy Day and "Do Your Own Dishes" and "The Aims and Means of the Catholic Worker" was a photo of my wife Joanne's hands. I hadn't seen it before. I hadn't been there for a while. I said to a couple guests I knew, I said, "Wow, that's a photo of Joanne's hands making rosemary shortbread in our kitchen." And I choked up. One of the guests who knew Joanne, Paul, pounded his chest a couple times with his fist and then silently pointed at me as if to say, We've got you, Doug. Another guest, Dale, who also knew Joanne, saw my tears, pointed at his eye and said, "Need something, Doug?" as if to offer to go get me a Kleenex. I was left to wonder just who's taking care of who at the Bethany House. There's a wonderful song by an organizer and songwriter named Cy Conn called "People Like You." You know that song, Barb?
I'm not sure. Sing it through Barb.
Thanks for the encouragement. Cy Conn is a wonderful songwriter. He also doesn't have much of a voice, so I'm going to give you the chorus. You know that people like you help people like me go on, go on. Yes, people like you help people like me go on, go on, go on. Thanks so much.